Please turn with me in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 4. I plan to read maybe at two or three different times during the study, and the first will be Genesis 4, beginning at verse 9 to the end of, almost the end of the chapter, actually, to verse 24. Now, you may remember from last week I stopped at verse 8, and so this is a logical place to begin only if you remember where we stopped last week. It's in the middle of the story of Cain and Abel. Genesis chapter 4, verse 9. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where is Abel, your brother?" He said, "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" And he said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its blood to receive your, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth." Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Surely you have driven me out this day from the face of the ground. I shall be hidden from your face. I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth, and it will happen that anyone who finds me will kill me." And the Lord said to him, "Therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city and called the name of the city after the name of his son, Enoch. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begot Mehujael, and Mehujael begot Methushael, and Methushael begot Lamech. Then Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of one was Adah, and the name of the second was Zillah. And Adah bore Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the harp and flute. And as for Zillah, she also bore Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every craftsman in bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Then Lamech said to his wives, "Adah and Zillah, hear my voice. Wives of Lamech, listen to my speech. For I have killed a man for wounding me, even a young man for hurting me. If Cain shall be avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. As I said, I plan to read a bit more of the different passages as we go along. This is the fifth week in our survey of the Old Testament, and we're beginning in Genesis chapter 5, but we're going to fly this week because we're going to cover almost two whole chapters, so hold on. Chapters that we're going to cover, 4 and 5 and part of 6, talk about first the line of that we just read about, the line of Cain. And then in the end of chapter 4 and the begin and through chapter 5 is the line of Seth, the godly line. And then, of course, chapter 6 begins the build-up to the flood with the description of the great wickedness in the earth and the singling out of Noah. Now, Jonathan Edwards, in his History of Redemption, makes the comment on this section, though the Mosaic history describing that space be very short, yet it is exceedingly comprehensive and instructive. And I hope we'll see that as we go along, that there is much to be learned even from this section that I read and from the others that we'll look at. I guess the theme is degeneration at first, and then some glimmers of hope. So degeneration and hope. Let's talk about degeneration first. And I'll have to admit, this is pretty gloomy, but that's part of the necessity for understanding the gospel, and the hope that we have in Christ is the gloom apart from Christ. So degeneration, contrary to the modern ideas of evolution and development, this is devolution, not in the sense of what they're doing in Scotland, but that is degeneration following the fall. And we talked already about the effects of the fall. right? The effects of the fall in terms fundamentally of death as separation from God. They're cast out of the Garden of Eden and away from the presence of God. And we talked about death, especially in its physical effects, that, and we'll see the rhythm of death in chapter 5, that man was doomed to die physically. But particularly in this section that we just read, there's the emphasis on the effects of the fall as death in its corrupting of the moral nature of man. And I thought it would be helpful just to read from the shorter catechism. It's dangerous to try to do it from memory, so I'll read it. Wherein consists the sinfulness of that estate whereinto man fell? The sinfulness of that estate whereinto man fell consists in the guilt of Adam's first sin, the wants or lack of original righteousness, and the corruption of his whole nature, which is commonly called original sin, together with all actual transgressions which proceed from it. And then the Catechism goes on to ask about the misery of that estate whereinto man fell. But it's important that you realize that when we read, for example, the last part of chapter 4, as we read it, that you see on the surface of it the effects of the fall. That is, we talked actually earlier on about the theological connection between Adam and his descendants that Paul develops, especially in the book of Romans, and especially in chapter 5 of the book of Romans. And in a sense, you have to wait until Romans to see the full theological development of original sin and our connection with Adam and so on. But, of course, it's on the surface of the text right here. It is directly because of Adam's fall that Cain kills Abel. I'm not saying Cain is not responsible, but the corruption of the moral nature that came with the fall is seen so clearly. Even in the degeneration, you may have noticed that the reaction of Cain to God is not the same as the reaction of Adam to God when Adam sought him out in the garden. Now, Adam did pass the buck, you know, the wife you gave to be with me, you know, she gave me of the tree and I did eat. But Cain's reaction to God when God confronts him in verse 9, "Where is Abel your brother?" is insolent. "I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper?" That already is a degeneration from the reaction of Adam. And even worse, you can see, of course, in Lamech. Lamech, we'll look at the details, but Lamech who boasts about his killing a man for a mere slight. And so there's on the surface of it this spreading that is, as men multiply, so do the effects of sin multiply. But you can see very clearly in these chapters that degeneration that I was talking about. Now, I'd like to look at that in a little bit of detail. And to do that, let's look back at chapter 4 a little bit more. Cain, as we read last week, had offered at the same time that Abel had made an offering, and Cain's offering was not accepted. It says in chapter 4, verse 5, he, God, did not respect Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. And God in his goodness comes to Cain and warns him, really, actually, interestingly enough, in the words that were given to the curse on the woman, that sin is at the door, his desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Sin desires to overtake Cain. And Cain, in a premeditated way, kills his brother. In verse 8, Cain talks with Abel, his brother, and when they're in the field, it appears to be premeditated. Cain rises up against Abel, his brother, and kills him. And I already mentioned that the generation is shown in Cain's insolent attitude toward God and saying, you know, "I'm not my brother's keeper, am I?" And a curse comes on Cain because of this. So that is that he will be, it says in verse 11, "You are cursed from the earth and you will be a vagabond." Cain asks for some mitigation of it, and so a mark is put on him for protection. Lamech, as I mentioned, is, however, worse. Lamech is the seventh in descendant from Adam through Cain, reckoned through Cain. And you can see here the further degeneration. For example, in verse 19 of chapter 4, the overturning of the original institution of marriage as a monogamous relationship. That is, Lamech, it says, takes for himself two wives. And that then goes on to describe later on in verse 23, he addresses his two wives in this taunting song, talking about his own exploits. He killed a man for wounding me, even a young man. The word for young man is sometimes translated child. I mean, this is a kid he picked on, apparently, for some minor fault for hurting him. Lamech avenges himself. So you can see the distinction here that in verse 24, Cain was promised a sevenfold vengeance from God. And what does Lamech say? He says, I'm man enough to take my own vengeance. And so he really pushes God even farther out of the scene and says, Lamech will avenge himself 77-fold. And he's already given, a down payment on it for this young man's slight against him. Now, in the midst of all this degeneration, there's an interesting description also of what I think should be called cultural development. That is, beginning in verse 20 and following. Right, there's nothing inherently wrong in dwelling in tents and having livestock. There's nothing inherently wrong in the development of music. These are good things in themselves, in fact. And we've enjoyed the Covington's livestock recently, thanks to their gift. So this, when I talk about degeneration, you shouldn't think that everything that's done here is necessarily wicked. There's a description in the ungodly line of things that are developed in terms of cultural richness. Those who play the harp and flute, there's craftsmen in bronze and iron, mentioned in verse 22. The question comes, you know, is it possible that only the godly are intelligent and able to do great things in terms of cultural development and so on? Well, obviously, no, that's not the case. The first description of cultural development is given in the ungodly line. But the question is, what benefit does it have for them? See, the attitude is, you know, if we increase cultural development, things will get better. You know, maybe their National Endowment for the Arts were funding these. Okay, joke. But, you know, maybe the idea was that somehow society would improve. They developed all these things, and apparently it didn't help Lamech very much. You know, midnight basketball and all that didn't help him because that was the last administration. And it says, you know, he is going to avenge himself. So the question then, as it is for us, is that men develop all these technological tools. I mean, in our day, the biotechnology is amazing. The question is, what are they going to do with them? Just because you can do it, is it right to do it? And will it really improve man? Or is the corruption of the nature of man such that he will twist even the good things that God put in, as we talked about, this very fertile earth, and very fertile in the sense of creative man, will he twist them to evil? And so that's the, I think that although it's a good cultural development, there's still the underlying theme that man will use even the good things for evil. Now, the last thing I'd like to say about this is simply the fact that there is no more mention of the line of Cain. Now, of course, you know what happens in chapter 6. There's a flood that wipes out all except Noah and his immediate family. And so it's pretty clear that that's the case. But this is an instance of what happens again and again, especially in Genesis. And this was something of the way of the Hebrew mind in dealing with matters. They would deal with the lesser things briefly, and then they would pass on from that to the much more important things. As our pastors preach through Genesis, we've seen that again and again. You know, he'll talk about Esau. This is the line of Esau, and Duke so-and-so, and Duke so-and-so. But then that was it, and now we go on to talk about Jacob. And Esau hardly ever reappears. So that's the same pattern here. There's a relatively brief section about Cain and his line. And then you hear almost nothing more of them past that point. And at verse 25 of chapter 4, the discussion picks up with the godly line, Seth, who takes the place of Abel. Any comments or questions? Well, let me pause here and see. That was a fairly, at least for my part, brief discussion of that section. I mean, I like cultural development. I, you know, snide references to the National Endowment for the Arts aside. Dave?
It is interesting that you get a sense in reading this section that the population of the wicked is growing.
Right. Yeah, and is it Edwards who makes that point that they had a head start, in a sense, because Cain killed Abel. Seth probably would have come along a lot later. And so there's this spreading wickedness. Even Cain doesn't say, you know, all of them are my immediate family, I'll be okay. He's worried that someone's going to kill him. So there's some multiplication of population that goes on, and it seems to be fairly widespread. Any other comments? Okay. All right, let me read then a bit of Genesis chapter 5. I'll start at 4:25, which is where I left off before. I'll read through the first, say, five verses of chapter 5. Genesis 4:25. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. Chapter 5. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and blessed them and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and begot a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. And he begot Seth, after he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Yeah, I think I'll just read that much of chapter 5. But let me just comment. You know, this is a somewhat familiar section. You know the rhythm that's established here. It's the same pattern. So-and-so lived this many years. He begot a son. The son lived so many years after that and had other sons, you know, he had other sons and daughters. And he lived this long, and he died. And with one exception, that's the ending of each of the descriptions in the line of Seth. Now, the glimmer of hope that I was talking about at the beginning is in this section. And it's hard to know whether the operative word is hope or glimmer, because it's a hope which is, apart from the grace of God, close to being extinguished. The hope is already seen in the naming and the description in verse 25 of the naming of Seth. God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. Now, the word seed, I think, in our minds should tie in with the promise in Genesis 3:15 that the seed of the woman would eventually bruise the seed of bruise the serpent himself, and that then is the initiation or the first instance in this section that we've read so far that they had a hope in that promise. I think there are references to it from what we saw last week, but here there is the idea that the godly line will not be extinguished. You should keep in mind this is not a given, as if somehow, you know, there'll always be someone to follow after God. And a corrupt race, they had to cling to the promise of God that there would be one in place of the godly Abel. And that's who Seth is seen to be. And there's a mention in verse 26 of men beginning to call on the name of the Lord. There's a lot of discussion about exactly what that means, but it seems to be, if I could use a modern term, there seems to be a critical mass. That is, there's not simply one individual or Adam and his wife, but enough together to call on the name of the Lord collectively. Sometimes it's referred to as the beginning of public worship. Whether it's the beginning of public worship or a great, in a sense, the first revival in which men were called together to call to worship God, it's a little hard to say from the mere statement here. But there is, again, the glimmer here of hope that there is not an isolated individual worshiping God, but men gathering together to worship Him. And of course, the chief act of worship is calling on the name of the Lord. So Calvin makes the comment here that although we tend to focus on the sacrifices in the Old Testament, the thing that God always honors is the calling on His name, whether it's in prayer or in sung praise or however it is. It's that heart obedience of response to call on God and to look to Him. the sacrifices were intended to point forward to Christ and the accomplishment of redemption. But here the pure worship of God is described. Now, chapter 5, let me just make a comment. Again, since we've had preaching through the book, I don't want to dwell too much on it. But the reference to the book of the genealogy of Adam, that phrase, in some sense, divides the book of Genesis into different sections. And it looks forward. That is, you know, when he says this is the book, is he looking back or is he looking forward? Well, our chapter division suggests, and I think it's in fact the case, that he's looking forward to the genealogy of Adam. That is, he's about to list the descendants. Now, this is, in the Septuagint translation, that's where we get the name Genesis in English for this book, from the Septuagint reference to this phrase and the other occurrences of it. There's, at the beginning of chapter 5, a brief rehearsal of what we saw in chapters 1 and 2. God created man in his likeness and blessed them, with reference to male and female. And then there's kind of a striking reference that the son of Adam in verse 3 is after his image. And again, that's man being fallen, that's kind of a mixed thing, isn't it? Man is still in the image of God. And so Seth, being after the image of Adam, is still in the image of God. And yet, the image of God has fallen. And so the fact that he's after Adam's image may tend to suggest what we're about to see through the chapter. That is, he's in the image of Adam, and like his father, he too will die. He too has a corrupt nature by birth and is separated from God apart from the work of reconciliation. And that then unfolds in the chapter. Again and again, as I mentioned, you see the pattern of death. And I said this early on, but it's very easy for us living in a fallen world to think that death is a natural thing. And that's, of course, what evolution suggests. Death is in some ways the means to evolution, although it involves certainly both procreation and death. But death is an unnatural thing in the scriptures. Death is an enemy, especially in terms of the work of Christ. Death is the enemy which Christ has overcome, and the sting is removed. And so when you read this, and he died, you should see that the ripple effects of Adam's sin throughout, and a reminder that if there is to be redemption, it must be on the part of God. Man is a doomed creature. Now, the one exception is a very intriguing one, of course, and that's verse 21. And let me read chapter 5, verse 21. Enoch lived 65 years, and he begot Methuselah. After he begot Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Now, I didn't read the entire chapter, but if you read it, imagine reading it for the first time and seeing this pattern of death, 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 and then he was not, for God took him. It stands out, doesn't it? It's a striking statement about Enoch. And Enoch is, of course, a very intriguing person, and I'm going to fall into the trap a little bit and think about some of the other references, the trap being to not just to skip over him, but I'd like to think a little bit about his circumstances and about the significance of this description from him, for him. First of all, it's interesting to note that there are other parallels in these two genealogies, that is, the line of Seth and the line of Cain, and I haven't really brought them out. But Lamech, this boastful man, was the seventh from Adam, and Enoch was the seventh from Adam also on the other side. And it's quite a contrast. They weren't necessarily contemporaries, but it's quite a contrast between the two who are in the seventh from Adam, either through Cain or through Seth. And there are references to Enoch which help us to understand what's said here. But we should look, first of all, at what it says. It says that he walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Now, the idea of walking with God is something familiar to us already, because when God came to Adam and Eve after the fall, it said that he was walking. They heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And so that intimate fellowship which they enjoyed in the garden is described here of Enoch in some ways in the Hebrew. It's even a stronger statement of that. It's an almost unparalleled description of fellowship with God. And that's an important point to make. The commentator Kidner, you know, points out that many times people understand the Old Testament just in terms of a harsh moralism. You know, you get this picture of Moses here with this law and like this. But the heart of Old Testament religion is walking with God. That's the description given here of Enoch. It's the same sort of description that's given of Noah in chapter 6. And Abraham is the friend of God. Those who are particularly mentioned as righteous men are men who are in fellowship with God, who walk with God. Now, how do they do that? Well, of course, they do it by faith. And here, compared to last week, I didn't put up very many cross references. Let's turn to Hebrews chapter 11, verses 5 and 6. I'm taking these out of the order in which I wrote them up there. We looked last week at Hebrews 11 and its description of Abel. It was faith that animated Abel's work and faith that made Abel's work acceptable to God. Stop talking and start turning here. And the writer to the Hebrews devotes two verses to Enoch. He found them interesting too. Okay, that's my justification. By faith, Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death, and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. But you see there, as I mentioned for Abel, that the Old Testament saints lived by faith even before Abraham, who was the first one we think of especially as being justified by faith. But it was faith which, as I said, gave Abel the strength to do what he did, and by which he found acceptance with God. And it was also that faith which animated Enoch. One other interesting reference, since we're in the New Testament, is in the book of Jude. So turn to Jude verses 14 and 15, next to the last book here, the New Testament. There's a reference here to a prophecy of Enoch. I'll read verses 14 and 15 of Jude. Now Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied about these men also, saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints, to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against them." Now, I didn't read the immediate context. He says, prophesied about these men, and he's talking about men in the context who are, well, spots in their love feasts, clouds without water, carried about by the winds, and so on. He's describing men who are in opposition to the gospel and rebellion against God. And it's interesting here that this prophecy of Enoch, which is not given elsewhere in the canonical scriptures, is recorded by Jude, first of all, and immediately to denote, to give encouragement. The Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. And that's a reference to the coming of the Lord, whether the second coming in final judgment, which I would tend to see, or whether it's simply a promise that the Lord will come. In any case, it's striking that the seventh from Adam should be given this insight, that the redemption would come from God, and not only redemption in the sense of deliverance of his people, but judgment on the ungodly. Calvin makes the comment here that the fact that there are 10,000s of his saints would have been an encouragement in a very ungodly time. And the ungodly time receives an emphasis in verse 15. Again, Enoch is looking forward, so he's talking about a future time when there will be judgment on all who are ungodly. The word ungodly, you may have noticed, appears several times in that verse. It's a description of a greatly degenerate race. Although it's a prophecy, one gets the sense from Genesis that Enoch probably knew what he was talking about. That is, he had seen plenty of these men in his own time, and he foresaw a judgment that would come on them and all of their ungodly descendants. So let's turn back to Genesis. Just those two New Testament references to Enoch are helpful, I think, for us to realize our connection with the Old Testament saints in terms of what true piety is, as well as the unhappy connection between the ungodly in Enoch's day and the prophesied judgment at the end. One other thing I'd like to mention, and then we'll move on, and that's the interesting phrase in verse 24, and back in Genesis 5, verse 24, for God took him. That phrase, God took him, or God received him, is used significantly enough twice in the Psalms. And here again, I'll do what I did before and put in a plug for the value of singing the Psalms. But both in Psalm 49 and in Psalm 23, the same phrase is taken up by the psalmist, who in Psalm 49 acknowledges the death will come to all as a rule. But he says, you will receive me. In Psalm 73, which is probably more familiar to us from our singing, afterwards in glory by thou shalt receive me to thy sight. That's the metrical version, more or less. And that receiving me to thy sight, that's the same phrase that's mentioned here in verse 24. God took him, or received him, the same Hebrew word. And you see, again, the Old Testament piety expressed in the Psalms, that is, the hope of the believer wasn't merely some physical promised land or slaughtering the Canaanites or something like that. His ultimate hope was in fellowship with God. And he had the confidence that even after death, God would receive him. Enoch did not die, but the hope of God taking him is the hope of all believers. Now, I'm not saying that those verses in the Psalms necessarily point forward to a resurrection of the dead. They're not as explicit as that. But there is the expectation, I am the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. As Christ says, he is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Christ pointed forward to that same hope from the book of Exodus. So here the fact that God took him is the keynote for the Psalter's hope of eternal fellowship with God. Now, there's more that could be said about the hope, but I've already gone on and on about Enoch. So much of that will come up next week, Lord willing, when we look at God's dealings with Adam, with Noah, and the covenant in connection with the flood. But let me pause again and see if you have any comments. We'll try to move on a bit to the prelude to the flood.
Okay. I find it interesting that even in verse 25 of chapter 4, when Seth comes along, Adam and Eve are still very much looking forward to this promise. That there's that theme of looking forward to a promise occurs a number of times, sometimes explicitly, sometimes not so explicitly. But it's encouraging that they didn't have a specific timetable in mind as to when this redemption was going to occur, but it doesn't. They're very clear in seeing that it will take place in the future.
Yeah. I was going to come back to that idea of a timetable at the end, so don't let me forget. That's my boss here. But that's right. We know Genesis 5, and we know there's a long line of death and so forth, and whether they had thought he might be or not, Seth was not the promised deliverer in the fullest sense. But they still held on to the hope of a deliverer coming.
Well, Cain is not mentioned in chapter 5.
That's right.
It's not there
at all.
That's right.
Yeah.
Eve knew that was not the seed. We don't have that explicitly mentioned in the negative, but we would see that information. So.
You're right. It's almost as if he's just not in their thinking at all. And, yeah. Let me read then if there aren't any other comments, the beginning of chapter 6. I think I'll just read the first 8 verses. Now it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful. And they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made him. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now, I don't intend, obviously, to cover the flood here in the remaining time, but I want to talk a little bit about the section that I just read, because it, in a sense, is the culmination of this sad story of degeneration that we've already read about. And part of that depends on the interpretation of the verses 1 through 3, which I understand, and Alcastra took it this way in his preaching also, to refer to an intermarriage between the godly line and the ungodly line. That is, the sons of God seeing the daughters of men would refer to those who were faithful to God in the line of the promise, and the daughters of men, by doing this, they showed themselves not to be faithful, but they were in the godly line, and they saw the daughters of men. The daughters of men would have reference to those who were rebellious against God, and so that is, this is a description of a marriage between a believer and an unbeliever, initiated on the part of unbelieving men. I said there's a question of interpretation. Some modern, or many modern commentators, take this to refer to some sort of strange angelic intermarriage with human women. Well, okay, I'm not going to go into the details of why I don't think that's what it says, but let me just make the point that that certainly does emphasize the point we've been stressing. That is, although there is a glimmer of hope in what we just read, yet there is widespread degeneracy. And if you think about the promise of God coming through the seed of the woman, and the seed of the woman now joining in marriage with the seed of the serpent, to use the language of the curse, you have cause to fear and tremble. Will God really fulfill his promise? Or is Satan, by this, seeking to destroy the line that God had promised altogether? So that's one thing that causes tremendous concern. And then there is, of course, the explicit statement, which I read fairly slowly in verse 5, of the destruction of the wickedness of man. You know, we believe in the doctrine of total depravity, whether you want to call it that, or radical depravity, or whatever. And there are various places in the scripture where you could get that doctrine. I would argue you could get it from Genesis 4 that we already read. But there's hardly a more explicit statement of the wickedness of man than verse 5 of Genesis 6. Every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Now, that's not just what he did. Those are the intents of the thoughts of his heart. God is the only one ultimately who knows the intents of the thoughts of the heart, although they tend to show up in the way people talk and live. But God's assessment of man is a very, very degenerate assessment. That is, it's a statement of the great degeneracy to which God sees man has come. And this, I didn't read verse 11 and 12, but the same statement is made again. The earth also was corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And there's the description in verse 13, of what God will do because of the great violence in the earth. Now, one could misunderstand what God has said as if somehow God was hoping that by the flood he would wash away all the wickedness. I mean, you could misunderstand that, you know, as if, well, we just need a better environment here with all these wicked people around. And this is the argument of Pelagius long ago, that men sin because they see sinners around them. They're not sinful by nature. And I know you wouldn't have gone down that road, but just to make it explicit, the text helps us after the flood. In chapter 8, verse 21, God says, "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth." God knows well enough that the nature of man isn't going to change by a flood. Even preserving Noah and his immediate family isn't going to wipe out wickedness from the earth. But there's something else that's significant here, and that is that God, in these chapters, lays before us what man would do when left to himself. That is, God gives a promise to Adam, but what would happen if God immediately redeemed Adam and Eve? That is, if there wasn't this line that we read about in 4 and 5 of the ungodly. Well, man would tend to not to understand the significance of corruption. And it's this unfolding, these chapters, culminating in the flood, which underlines so clearly the desperate condition of man. And it's that desperate condition that gives context to the gospel, right? Without that, without the understanding of the depravity of the human heart, as I'm sure you all have known whenever you've tried to evangelize people, without the understanding of the depravity of the heart, the gospel doesn't really make much sense. So I mentioned in connection with what Dave said about the timetable, though I wanted to read from what Voss said, and I'll try to conclude with this. I mentioned before, Voss was characterized by J.I. Packer as being muddy, so I'm trying to read the less muddy parts. That is, it's a little hard to understand what he's saying. He says, it contents itself, this description of this period before the flood, it contents itself with bestowing a minimum of grace. A minimum could not be avoided either in the sphere of nature or of redemption, because in this former sphere, without at least some degree of divine interposition, collapse of the world fabric would have resulted. And in the latter, the sphere of redemption, the continuity of fulfillment of the promise would have been broken off, had special grace been entirely withdrawn. These two features find their explanation in the purpose of the period in general. It was intended to bring out the consequences of sin when left so far as possible to itself. If God permitted grace freely to flow out into the world and to gather great strength within a short period, then the true nature and consequences of sin would have been very imperfectly disclosed. Man would have ascribed to his own relative goodness what was in reality a product of the grace of God. Hence, before the work of redemption is further carried out, the downward tendency of sin is clearly illustrated, in order that subsequently, in the light of this downgrade movement, the true divine cause of the upward course of redemption might be appreciated. So, of course, he acknowledges there that it's by God's grace that a line is preserved at all. And yet the characteristic of the period is that degeneracy, which I suppose, in which the darkness only makes the little light shine brighter in terms of the hope that comes through Noah and looking forward to a Redeemer. So this is, I guess it's kind of a strange way, because I talked about part of the preludes of the flood, but not all of it, and I'll plan to look at that next week, and the covenant with Noah, and we'll probably cover, 15 chapters at least. No, okay, well, we'll probably cover Genesis 6 through 9 next week if you want to look ahead, but we're picking up steam, for sure. Any comments or questions? Someone once told me of an Old Testament survey at a Christian college, at Geneva College, in which the book of Genesis occupied the entire first semester. So, you can see how fast I'm really going compared to that. Any comments? Okay, let's close in prayer.